Over 200,000 of the homeless people in the United States of America are women and girls. The most needed and understocked item in homeless shelters, feminine hygiene products. Joy Road Media is proud to tell you about the Clean Love Project. The Clean Love Project's mission is to help women and young girls feel clean, loved, and empowered by distributing clean love kits to alleviate their hygiene needs. Go to thecleanloveproject.org to find out how you can help. The Clean Love Project focuses on the Metro Detroit area, but it also distributes kits worldwide. If you are a female in need of a clean love kit, go to thecleanloveproject.org and request one today. Joy Road Media is a proud supporter of the Clean Love Project at thecleanloveproject.org.
See, I got the idea. The last liquor store we stuck up, remember all those customers that kept coming in?
Yeah.
Then you got the idea to take everyone's wallet.
Uh-huh.
That was a good idea.
Thanks.
We made more from the wallets than we did at the register.
Yes, we did.
A lot of people go to restaurants.
A lot of wallets.
Pretty smart, huh?
Pretty smart. I'm ready. Let's go right here, right now.
Remember, same as before. You're crowd control. I handle the employees.
Got it. I love you, Pumpkin.
I love you, Honey Bunny. Everybody be cool. This is a robbery.
Any of you fucking pricks move, and I'll execute every one of you motherfuckers. Got that?
You made me watch. Why'd you make me watch this? You made me watch something I didn't like. Next time we'll watch.
So we're going to be talking about an Amanda Plummer movie this week.
Yeah, we are. So I'm Allison Bobbitt.
And I'm Pumpkin Bobbitt.
You're Pumpkin Bobbitt. And this week, Mike, you made me watch The Fisher King.
You made me watch.
Why did you make me watch those?
So The Fisher King is a 1991 American comedy drama film written by Richard Lagravenesi, who also wrote, strangely enough, Behind the Candelabra, the Liberace movie.
Really?
Uh-huh. And in the early 80s, he was billed as Double R, a comedy duo, with a fellow playwright, Richard O'Donnell. And, you know, together they wrote and performed in a bunch of off-Broadway productions. And mm-hmm. Here's my connection to him. He's an uncredited writer on Conviction with Hilary Swank.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. That movie that you were an extra on.
Uh-huh.
Where she was the most annoying pick me girl ever.
Minnie Driver and Hilary Swank hated each other.
That's so funny.
Fisher King is directed by Terry Gilliam, born in Minnesota, spent mm-hmm. high school and college in L.A., where he was a cartoonist and an animator.
Mm-hmm.
He moved to the U.K., joined Monty Python as an animator before becoming a cast member. And he's the only Monty Python member not born in Great Britain,
mm-hmm.
but he did become a naturalized British citizen when George W. Bush was president.
Oh, God. That's...
He renounced his American citizenship.
Fair.
So this is a movie about a Howard Stern type shock jock who inadvertently gets one of his listeners to go on a killing spree inside of a restaurant bar, and then it takes place 3 years after that,
mm-hmm.
where his life is in shambles and he happens across a homeless man who, it turns out, his wife was killed in that mass shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And the homeless man was a college professor who studied Arthurian legends,
mm-hmm.
and is now living the legend of the Fisher King.
Yeah.
And that's basically the overview of the movie. I already know the answer to this.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie that was also recommended by your dad.
Yeah.
What up, Pops?
He's going to be like, oh my God.
Yeah. Your dad... Your dad actually has a track record of having really solid taste in movies.
He does, yeah.
I like to give him crap. He loves Caddyshack. I like to tell him that I'm a bigger fan of Caddyshack, too.
I know. And he's like, Jesus Christ.
but he knows I'm joking.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
But so tell me how much you like this movie.
First thing, I was like, why did you guys want to make me cry? Because this was very emotional, but this was such a good movie, still incredibly relevant.
Oh yeah.
Considering that unfortunately gun violence is still a huge issue in the country.
Arguably bigger than it was in 1991.
Much bigger problem now. But God, just, and I mean, you're really just looking at this little, like, I guess kind of like microcosm of like how this affected these two people,
mm-hmm.
when you know it affected many more.
Yeah.
And how it absolutely destroyed these people.
Yeah. We have friends whose kids go to Oxford High School.
Yeah.
And one of the stories that hasn't really made the news is, in addition to the people that were killed, the children that were killed.
The children, yes.
That during the horrific attack, one of our friends' kids' friends ended up killing themselves later because of the PTSD that she was dealing with because of this. So this is a thing that not only will wreck, you know, the victims, but it can also, you know, survivor guilt can be so brutal.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think in 1991 we had that terminology, but that's clearly what the Perry character played by Robin Williams is dealing with.
Yeah.
His wife, it's such a brutal, that brutal scene. Sequence.
Oh,
his
God.
Wife is shot in the head and
right in front of him.
And he is splattered with
her face and brains. Yeah, like
it is a horrific,
graphic.
It is. Yeah. It is the most graphic shot in the movie, but and it is a gratuitous shot in the movie, but I think it's important to show what broke this poor man.
Yeah. Like he goes into a state of like catatonia, like where he can't move, can't talk.
Yeah.
Like can't function because he saw the most horrifying thing. Like he's literally having a conversation with his wife, she's laughing, and a guy walks in and everything changes in an instant.
Yeah. So I was trying to go through mentally without actually looking at the list, but I think we've probably watched more Robin Williams movies on the podcast than we have movies with anyone else.
I think you're right.
We've also done World According to Garp, Mrs. Doubtfire, Jumanji, and Flubber.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this rank for you?
I think this is the best one.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the best Robin Williams movie I think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love this movie, but I think I may. It's a tough one because maybe it's the book, The World According to Garp, I love more. This is my favorite Robin Williams movie that we've watched on the podcast so far. Only because it probably could be The World According to Garp, but I do like that book so much more than the movie. Coincidentally, Amanda Plummer, who is in this movie playing Robin Williams' love interest, is in The World According to Garp. She is the girl who the women's group is based around that was raped and had her tongue cut out.
Yeah.
So she has no lines in World According to Garp. In the book, she's actually sort of like a daughter figure to the Garp character.
Mm-hmm.
But that storyline's cut out of the movie.
Yeah.
But it's kind of hard to keep coming up with new Robin Williams trivia because we've covered him so many times.
Yeah.
But he did go to Detroit Country Day with Courtney B. Vance, who you probably remember most from Lovecraft Country.
I do.
He's also going to be in the live-action Lilo and Stitch movie playing Cobra Bubbles.
Yes! Yeah, that's awesome.
Which is a shame that it can't be Ving Rhames.
Ving Rhames, yes.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that's... Clearly, that character, down to the Band-Aid, is based on Ving Rhames.
Obviously, yes.
Yeah. And then to bring it to true crime, because I know that's your life, Courtney B. Vance also played Johnny Cochran in The People versus O.J. Simpson.
Yes, he did, and he was fantastic in that.
Yeah.
Is Courtney B. Vance the one who's married to Angela Bassett?
I don't know.
I know he's married to someone.
That's a powerhouse acting duo, if it is.
Hold, please.
When you say the one, what do you mean by that?
The guy. Yep, Angela Bassett.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because I was like, I know Angela Bassett is has been married to another actor, like another famous actor for a really long time. And so I was pretty sure it was
Courtney.
Terry
Gilliam notoriously has a really hard time getting movies made, but he said that this is one of the easiest experiences he ever had.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with Robin Williams again on Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which I don't think you have seen.
Nope.
But Robin Williams has essentially a cameo in that.
Mm.
And Terry Gilliam, who's kind of a curmudgeonly guy, said this of Robin Williams. Williams had the ability to go from manic to mad to tender to invulnerable. He had the most unique mind on the planet. There's nobody like him out there.
Yeah.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Bridges also praised Robin Williams quite a bit. He said that this movie was like jazz, where everyone's doing all this like crazy improv, you know, just kind of doing their own thing. But Robin Williams was the baseline that held the groove together.
Yeah.
And no matter where you were going on your little solo, you could always count on that Robin Williams baseline to bring you back to the groove of the music or to the movie. And I thought that was such a brilliant way of putting it.
Yeah. Jeff Bridges was also amazing in this. Also, he's so young. He's so young in this that I kept looking at him and thinking it was Val Kilmer.
Yeah, because he plays a Howard Stern type shock jock. And the earlier scenes where he's like all clean shaven.
Yeah.
And, you know,
with like the hair and
and he's not like drinking out of control and everything. He definitely had a lot of Val Kilmer quality. In fact, he thought he was so wrong for this role. He's like, listen, I'm not a Howard Stern guy.
Yeah.
When Terry Gilliam wanted him, he was like, you know, I got a whole bunch of friends who I think would do a better job, and I can put you in touch with any of them. Because I'm complimented by you offering me this role, but I am just not right for it. And he was wrong.
He was wrong. He was so good.
Yeah. He had another sweet story, too, that when they were making this movie, there was a homeless guy who looked a lot like the Perry character to the point that Jeff Bridges was like, I wonder if they modeled, you know, off of this guy. And this guy apparently would, like, just ride his bike to film sets to just watch movies being filmed and everything. And Jeff Bridges happened to be in New York on the week that Robin Williams died, and he saw that homeless man, and for a second he was just like, it just felt like a magical moment where he was like, this guy who reminded me so much of Robin was there. So the only Academy Award for this went to Mercedes Rule. It's her only nomination, and it is her, it's a win for her.
Mm-hmm.
We saw her just recently in The Warriors.
Yes, we did.
She was almost a cast member on SNL.
Really?
She lost out to Denny Dillon. She was super nervous about doing the sex scenes in this movie.
Really?
With Jeff Bridges. And he saw how nervous she was. And mm-hmm. he was like, come here, let's go for a walk. And he walked with her and held her hand and was just like, you know, we're going to be professional and you are going to be absolutely phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And you have nothing to worry about because you are an amazing actor and I know you can do it. And she was like, it just put me at ease knowing yeah. that I had a scene partner who really cared about my feelings there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I'm sure that definitely would put you at ease that you know someone like respects you and.
Yeah. I like that I could only find people saying really positive things about making this movie. And
yeah.
A lot of the interviews I saw were when Robin Williams was still alive. So it isn't one of those things that everyone's like, well, in retrospect, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, no, like everyone really had a pleasant experience mm-hmm. making this. The whole cast is amazing. Amanda Plummer, who mm-hmm. we've talked about. I'm sure I've said this before because she's popped up on the podcast and I feel like it was a familiar thing when, like, at first I was like, oh my God, I didn't know that. But then I had that feeling where it was like, yeah, you did. Her dad is Christopher Plummer.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I did know that. We've probably covered that on the podcast before.
Yeah, I think so.
From I thought this was funny. People probably most know him from The Sound of Music that he calls The Sound of Mucus.
Oh my God.
He said he found all aspects of making the film unpleasant except for working with Julie Andrews. And he avoids using its name. He'll either call it That Movie, S&M, or The Sound of Mucus.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Christian Clemenson, who plays Edwin Malnick, the guy who does the shooting.
Yeah.
We saw him on the podcast before. He played the doctor in Malignant.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
But apparently he also won an Emmy for a run on Boston Legal. So
weird.
Michael Jeter, who played the homeless cabaret yeah, singer. Mm-hmm. Just a phenomenal
God,
character
yeah,
actor.
I know. I miss him. It's so sad that he died so young.
You know, he was only 50 years
yes,
old when he died.
I know. He was only 50.
And
it's horrible.
He was in his 30s when he made this.
Really?
Yeah.
He just looked the same age his yeah. whole life, I think.
He would have been 38 when he was in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he's definitely one of those people that with the mustache, it really changes the way he looks
mm-hmm.
because like he very athletic, you know.
Yeah.
He like some people call it like, you know, that lean muscle, like a swimmer's mm-hmm. build and everything.
Yeah.
I call it a gay build. It seems like every gay guy uh-huh. that I am friends with, unless he is a bear, has that same like.
Very
like, oh, I didn't notice until I saw that shirt that's a little too small for you that you are actually very cut.
Very
you
know? Fit, yes. Yeah. That very like sinewy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Taut. Yeah, there's like shots of Michael Jeter and the Green Mile where he's just wearing like a, you know, sleeveless kind of tank top
mm-hmm.
and you can see like his shoulders and it's like, all right, scrawny little man ain't so scrawny.
Yeah. Like he's just short.
Yeah. All. He played Mr. Noodle's brother, Mr. Noodle on Sesame
yep.
Street.
I know.
Sesame Street dedicated an episode to him. Mm. And this probably would have been a podcast movie, but we ended up watching it during our hiatus.
Mm.
His final movie is Polar Express.
Yes.
That I finally watched this year for the first
yeah.
time.
Yeah. And also we both decided that the CG wasn't quite as creepy as everyone
I
made
decided.
It out to be.
You were like, oh, it's still weird.
It is a little creepy still. Like, it's definitely, you said because you were used to playing video games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't play video games. So I was like, no, like, the eyes are weird, but it's not terrifying the way.
Speaking of creepy and weird, we also saw Michael Jeter in Waterworld.
We did. Yes.
Speaking of gays, David Hyde Pierce.
He plays Jeff Bridges' agent, mm-hmm. Lou.
Yep, Harry Shearer from The Simpsons plays the actor who gets the role that Jeff Bridges was hoping that he would get.
Yeah,
they, but playing his TV, the sitcom wife, is Melinda Kalia, who I saw because she was one of the regulars, I believe, on season two of the A-Team when they were like, man, we got to bring a woman into the A-Team.
Oh, so
she played a reporter named Amy, basically doing the same like April O'Neil Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles role.
Got it.
Ted Ross played the limo bum, who's also in a real brief like shot in a cut scene. He played the lion in The Wiz.
Oh, nice.
Kathy Najimy is in
this. Yes. She's like a lady in the video store that Mercedes Rule owns.
Yep. John DeLancey, who played Q in Star Trek Next Generation.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And played Eugene in Days of Our Lives, which is where I first remember him from. Plays a TV veteran. And the great Tom Waits plays a disabled veteran. Basically plays Tom Waits as a disabled veteran.
Correct.
This is a movie I would definitely like to own the Criterion Collection version.
Yeah, that would be really interesting to watch.
They came out with a re-release of it last year with a brand new like 4K restoration of
it. Oh, wow.
So I think I'm going to look for that.
One of the things about this movie that was so wildly affected me was how much responsibility Jeff Bridges took for what happened to these people.
Yeah.
Like he, and I mean, even like the news reporter in the beginning is like, this guy went into this, you know, restaurant bar where, you know, and Jeff Bridges' character says like, you know, it's a bunch of yuppies. They think they're better than everybody. You know, you don't need to deal with that kind of shit. They think they're better than everybody. Don't waste your time. It was basically what he was saying to the Edwin guy.
Yeah.
And he takes it completely wrong and he snaps and he kills all these people. And even the news reporter is like, it's an offhanded remark that the DJ said. Like, nobody's really blaming him. He completely blames himself.
Right. Because when, spoiler alert, at the end, when he goes to get his job back, the job's waiting for him.
Yeah.
Like he gets right back. Like he is in
a self-imposed
isolation.
Yeah.
He exiled himself. It kind of goes along with the story of the Fisher King, which there are many versions of, but the one that Robin Williams tells in the movie is about, you know, a guy who sees the Holy Grail in fire and he goes for it and it disappears, but he's badly burned. And, you know, it's kind of one of those Joseph Campbell, like hero tales, one of those motifs that keeps repeating, like, you know, other versions of it is the Fisher King is badly injured and he's waiting for a healer, Percival, Perry, to save him. And, you know, that's essentially what happens in this story.
Yeah.
You know, that all of his wounds that he has are his own.
Yeah.
In his head, you know, self-inflicted.
Yeah. And because you would think you just see him like say this thing to this guy on air and then you just kind of follow him through the rest of his day where he's like, okay, like I'm gonna go home and I'm gonna like work on, you know, this script because I'm gonna audition. And
yeah,
he's
gonna be a sitcom star. It's kind of suiting that the catchphrase that the character has on it, I believe, is forgive me.
Yeah.
Where it's that he wants people to forgive him.
Yes.
Yeah. It's so, I love when there's the theme
nods. Yeah.
Of the movie is so solid that there are so many details that support that theme.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a perfect movie.
I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely is.
I'm a big fan of William Goldman, who wrote Princess Bride and Butch Cassidy mm-hmm. and Sundance Kid and Marathon Man. And, you know, he's one of the greatest screenwriters ever. And he wrote a book about the business of movies and everything. And in it, at the end, he finds a short story that he wrote and he converts it to a script. And then he has a bunch of people give him, you know, notes on it, like Hollywood people, like mm-hmm. an art director, a director, a composer and stuff like that. And it's all about this barber who gives magical haircuts. It just has a magical effect on people. He describes it very flowery. And Walter Hill is the director that, you know, he shares it with. And Walter Hill basically tells him, fuck off. All this flowery bullshit speech and everything. Like, hey, how am I supposed to shoot that? And the reason I bring the story up is because the script for this says that Jeff Bridges is in Grand Central Station and he hears a homeless woman singing mm-hmm. and it just has this profound effect on him that makes him, it just speaks of like a great love. And mm-hmm. you know, so how do you shoot something like that? You have 400 extras doing the waltz in Grand Central Station
mm-hmm.
and it's like, no, if you are a creative filmmaker, you can, you know, and Walter Hill, you know, great filmmaker.
Yeah.
But
Mike cutting in from the future here. I've confused my Walter Hills with my George Roy Hills. So every time I say Walter Hill in this section, please know that I meant George Roy Hill. I say this mostly for people like Johnny Mockney who might be listening to this episode. I don't want him to think I'm a poser.
I think he did The Sting.
No, he didn't.
You know, not mistaken, but or am I thinking George Roy Hill?
Yes, you are.
I might be thinking George Roy. Anyway.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yes, it does, Allison.
Matters to me.
Oh, my God.
It matters to Johnny Mockney if he listens. Listen to We Are Movies with Johnny Mockney.
Yes.
Who has an encyclopedic knowledge of movies at his fingertips.
Well, he'll tell you after he hears this episode and we can do a corrections corner, okay?
Oh, right. I know.
All right.
But yeah, that scene is amazing.
It and is, yeah.
They lit it from outside to make it look like 5 p.m. And they had from 8 p.m. at night when Grand Central Station would close until it opened again at 5:30 in the morning. And that is a beautiful scene.
I know. It's so gorgeous. You're just like, oh my gosh, they're literally all of these extras just come together. And it just seamlessly turns into this beautiful just ballroom and all of these extras are doing the waltz.
I like a lot of Terry Gilliam movies, but I think this may be my favorite one too.
Yeah, it's really good.
James Cameron almost directed this.
Oh.
You wouldn't have gotten a sequence like that with him. In fact, his vision for this was just kind of a reality-based caper of trying to steal that grail.
Oh, no, thank you. Anyway, one of the things I was saying earlier was just that, like, you know, in the beginning, we're watching, you know, Jeff Bridges, like, talk to this guy, then go about his day. And then, you know, he's riding this high where he's feeling so great. And he turns on the television and sees the news that this guy killed a bunch of people. And then it just cuts to 3 years later and he's just, his life is just in shambles. But to further what you just said, like, there are these like really magical moments throughout. Like, there's the part where Jeff Bridges is like walking around and he's outside of, it looks like he's outside of the plaza, and there's like this wealthy dad and his son like walking out and they're trying to get into like their car or their limo or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the son is holding like a toy Pinocchio.
Yeah.
And he just walks up to him and is like, here, Mr. Bum, this is for you. And so he just has like a toy. It's like such a random thing, but he ends up carrying it around with him and like ends up giving it to Perry.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so crazy. Like, just these random, like, kind of magical things happen. We also see Robin Williams naked, which is weird.
Yeah, a bunch.
Yeah, I was like, wow. I also am like, you know, I feel like with high def, we weren't supposed to see full frontal.
Yeah, I don't remember. Well, I don't know. In World's Greatest Dad, I think he's there's full frontal there too. But so,
well, I think in Fisher King we weren't supposed to see it.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
I think it was because it was dark. So I feel like when he turns around, we're not supposed to see it because it was the way it was lit. And I was like, high def came around and now we do. I was like, well, all right. Because he's mostly shaking his butt at the camera. And I was like, that is a hairy man.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
Yeah. And I don't know what I can add to that. Way to go, Robin Williams, being careful I or comfortable with that nudity, because you know, you see a lot of full frontal male nudity in movies like Saltburn, and
ooh,
you know, it's because the actor has a lot to be proud of, but Robin Williams is very average, and yep, and totally cool with it. So
hey, it might have been cold out too, you know.
Yeah. So anyway, one of the men who attacks Jeff Bridges and tries to light him on fire is played by Dan Futterman, who is in one of your favorite Robin Williams movies. He plays Robin Williams' son in The Birdcage.
Yes, correct. I love that movie so much.
The Japanese baseball shirt that Jeff Bridges wears in this movie is also the same shirt that he wears in The Big Lebowski.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. That Percival/Perry Arthurian legend.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember if we watched this for the podcast or not, but Percival is also the name of the lead character, his handle in Ready Player One, which is also an homage to that Arthurian legend.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
Real quick.
You're not going to start talking about Robin Williams' schlong again.
No, 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 no. When you said the thing about Jeff Bridges being lit on fire, I was reminded of the scene where he's about to, like, kill himself. So he's about to just jump into the river, and he's got like fucking, he's got the Pinocchio tied to his leg, but he's also got cinder blocks tied to his feet, and he's like just got tears streaming down his face, and he's about to like kill himself and drown himself in the river, and he's literally saved by two kids who just want to beat him up for, they think he's a homeless person. So they just want to beat him up for, like, being homeless in their neighborhood. Yeah. And then a bunch of actual homeless people show up and, like, beat those kids up and rescue him.
I feel like those kids were the kind of bros that would have been a big fan of his DJ, like, character. So, like, you would think that they would go, like, oh, wait, you're Jack Lucas.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
What happened to you, man? You know.
Yeah, like had they known, they would have been like, "Oh my god!" Yeah. But
they asked Howard Stern, you know, if they could talk to him for this movie, and Howard Stern wanted a consultant fee, and they were like, "Eh, nah."
So, yeah, Howard Stern, I have mixed feelings about him because I worked at a summer camp where his daughters went to when they were younger. And
can you pick those up?
Pick what up?
His daughter's names. Name drop in there.
I wasn't their counselor or anything. I didn't know them. And I never met him.
But if they had drowned, you would have been the one to save them.
I guess. I don't know. I didn't know them. I like saw them, but I wasn't their counselor. I didn't know them. Mm-hmm. And I never saw him because, like, if the kids had, like, really famous parents, they didn't come on, like, regular Parents' Day. They would come, like, at a different time. And
that's so weird.
It was, like, yeah. Because, like, Kate Spade's daughter was one of them. So she came, like, on a different day for Parents' Day. But, like, so Howard Stern came. And so I didn't see him because it was, like, you know, they don't want to make a big deal out of him being there. So it's more private, like, when he visits with his kids. Like, yeah. So, but he was apparently, like, very nice to everybody, like, the people that he interacted with. I mean, it's nice that was seemingly, you know, pleasant and, like, his kids were very happy to see him. Yeah. But also, like, it's a summer camp where they're gone for 8 weeks in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, I've told this story before. I don't remember where, but I worked at 97.1, the FM talk station, when it was an FM talk station in Detroit, and Tom Likas was syndicated on the station, and he broadcast it from Detroit for a couple days or whatever, and I was there when he was in, and he was just kind of coming in right beforehand, and we set up an area for him to do show prep and whatever, and he's like, what prep? Like, I come on and I just be a gross dirt bag and tell people that women are terrible. It's just a stupid shtick.
Yeah. You know,
like, and I imagine that Howard Stern, you know,
is similar.
It's a bit of a character.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of amp it up, and it's sort of like me on stage versus me off stage.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to say things with a microphone I wouldn't say without a microphone. Like,
yeah.
I feel like a certain amount of his persona is a character, and yeah,
I would agree. Yeah. 'Cause, like, he's married, and his wife runs a animal rescue.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually, like, fosters a bunch of, like, of cats and, like, rabbits and stuff, like, out of their home. And he, like, does, like, watercolors and stuff, and, like, does artwork for, like, her, like, fundraisers for, like, shirts and things that she sells for her charity. Like,
oh, okay.
So
he seems pretty happily married now, but
yeah.
Then again, he seemed happily married before too, but, you know,
who knows?
Whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know. He's, yeah. I think his show is gross. You know, I don't love a guy who's like, what size are your boobs? You know, like, how much do you weigh? Like, shut up.
I mean, his celebrity interviews were pretty interesting because he wouldn't ask the run-of-the-mill kind of questions. Like, he would do really long-form interviews with people where, you know, that really hadn't happened, you know, outside of, like, Larry King in quite some time.
That's so true, yeah. You know,
I think he's a good interviewer, and, you
I think
know,
he's
there's certainly a bit
better
of
now.
Anyway, so back to the movie.
Yeah. Sorry. Tangent.
I'm glad that you really liked this.
It was so good. And like I said, it is incredibly relevant now because it's incredibly representative of, like, a lot of very current issues.
Yeah.
And how the feelings of, you know, guilt over, you know, maybe feeling responsible for the actions of other people when, you know, not intending to set someone off, but your words or actions being misinterpreted or just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, things like survivor's guilt.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, because you like this so much, and I knew immediately, my first instinct was, well, I'm going to make you do, because I have another Terry Gilliam movie on my list, but I don't want you to get Terry Gilliam overload, especially because this other Terry Gilliam movie on the list isn't nearly as good as The Fisher King.
Mm.
But for the next one I make you watch, it will not be one that will make you cry. So I think I'm going to go in a separate direction completely.
Okay.
So do you know what you're going to make me watch next week?
I do.
Okay. You want to give me any hints?
Yeah, it's going to be light because I'm a little too emotional.
Please tell me that Cameron Diaz won't be in it.
She will be. but it's just a cameo.
Oh no.
No, I think you might like it.
Okay.
Let me tell you. Ready?
Yeah.
We're gonna watch the 2002 comedy Slackers.
Slackers plural?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know this movie. I know Slacker, the Richard Linklater movie, but
no.
I am not familiar with Slackers. So no.
It is Devin Sawa, Jamie King, Jason Segel.
Oh, wow.
Michael C. Marona, who was one of the Peets from The Adventures of Pete and Pete, and Jason Schwartzman, and Laura Prepon.
Okay. I listened to a podcast about The Adventures of Pete and Pete, and I really want to watch it now.
I don't know if it's streaming anywhere right now.
Apparently it isn't. That was one of the things they said on the podcast. So.
Well, maybe I can maybe get DVDs of it somewhere or something.
I don't know that I want to see it that badly.
Well, I do.
We own a lot of DVDs of TV shows that I was like, oh, yeah, I really want to watch that. And then I watch one episode, and I'm like, meh, doesn't hold up.
Well, maybe it'll start streaming again soon.
Yeah. Thank you again for watching this.
And thank you.
I am really glad that you enjoyed it, honey bunny.
Me too. Thank you, boo.
All right. Well, we're in the diner and we have all these people hostage. So I suppose we should probably take their wallets. Why don't you go get that fellow with the wallet who says bad motherfucker and start with him.
Okay. Sounds good. All right.
I love you.
I love you too.
And thank you everyone for listening to another episode of You Made Me Watch.
Okay, bye.